This is Michael Johnston, a host on New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Today I'll be talking with Jonathan Wynn about his new book, Music City, American Festivals and Placemaking in Austin, Nashville, and Newport.
First, we'll start off by talking a little bit about each of these locations. Could you tell me a little bit about each place?
I would say that at least how I got interested in them is I was thinking about, I had some experience in each of the locations, but I was interested in the kinds of places that are known for music. I'm a fan of music. I'm a fan of kind of sociology of music. And I was thinking about different kinds of cities and their character and their commitments and their place attachment to music. And as somebody who studies cities and culture, you know, there's only so many places that really come to mind when you think that there's something really, really a close bonding between music and place. And Chicago is well trodden ground for urban sociology. There's a great book that was just coming out on New Orleans by Kevin Fox Gotham called Authentic New Orleans. And Diane Grahams also has a great book about local culture in New Orleans. Seattle would have been a reasonable choice for me. Memphis could have been a reasonable choice for me. But there seemed like something really interesting to me that was going on in Austin, which has a kind of very countercultural music movement going on. And in Austin, it's also a lovely place to visit, which is nothing when you do, you know, kind of embedded participant observation work. Nashville is well known as being a music city location, and I was interested in country music as and how it became the kind of dominant force in a city like Nashville. And then there was also Newport, which I'd been going to kind of casually as a music listener to the Newport Folk Festival, and I had noticed it's, you know, kind of being in the New England area. And its history of being kind of known for its folk festival and its jazz festival. It's kind of like has these twin festivals that they have going on. And so those are three locations I thought were kind of interesting to me. And so I started zeroing in on that for my research. And they definitely are curious places. I'm glad I wrote about them in retrospect.
And each of these places, the design had an impact on the experience that you had, as well as the experience that some of the different agents in these locations had. Could you tell me a little bit about how such a design has such an impact on the way that the people interact with their environment?
Do you mean, I'm sorry, the design, the urban design of the city itself? Do you mean, I'm
the,
sorry.
The festival. I think the festival. Also the festival, but I think that the city also had an impact on the way that the festival was carried out. For example, you said you wrote in your book that Nashville, the festival was originally held at their, on the outskirts of town at the, at the fairgrounds.
Yeah.
It was moved inward into the community. And the way that people carried out their everyday lives at the event, at that festivity, varied from the two different locations.
Yes, yes. Right, yeah, no, I think that's more, you know, kind of some of the way that I was thinking about the festivals, and I think you're exactly right. So when in my research, it's called Music/City because I see these two things as being very, very connected, very, very intertwined. So Music City, not Music Cities, because I was interested in the two of them as kind of co-equal components of the space. And so, but yes, I was interested in I noticed in my research that the festivals had very different positionalities towards the city. They were kind of differently related. And so festivals are one of the ways that people get to experience cities. Not the only way. There are also festivals that don't have relationships with cities. I'm thinking of like Bonnaroo, for example, which is also in Tennessee, or Coachella, which is in Indio, California, which don't necessarily have a lot to do with cities. They're kind of cities unto themselves, or like Burning Man, for example, which is a temporary city. And so these festivals, I was interested in how they were kind of related to place. And I came up with a kind of three model approach where each of the festivals that I was seeing at were positioned a little bit differently. The Newport Folk Festival is a walled off festival, which is 10,000 people go to a location that has fencing and it has food trucks there and it has music and it has water and it has activities. And it's all kind of I call it a citadel model. It's kind of walled off. And then the second model that I saw was was scattered throughout the entire city. And that was much like Austin, Texas, and the South by Southwest festival, music festival. There's other parts of the South by Southwest now. But and that just uses all these different locations, so parking garages and music venues and restaurants and empty lots, and there was all these kind of scattered around the downtown area that comprises the city. And I said that's something different. So the citadel is something that is separate from the city and kind of walled off in some way, where all the resources and activity and the engagement was all going on in a confined geographic space. And the what I call confetti model, which is spread out everywhere, allows the festival to be a part of the urban fabric in a very different way, and also allows the urban fabric to be relate itself to the festival more, so that you had activities that were not official South by Southwest events being still participating in the festival and adding to that experience. And there's obvious problems that I'd be more than happy to talk to, in regards to that, positives and negatives to that kind of approach that kind of a festival format. And then the middle ground I call the core, which is, alliteration is always good. So the festival is a confetti, core, and citadel, being three C's. And the core is using a core set of amenities that are within a downtown network. So a sports stadium, a public park, a downtown, street, a convention center. Those are all, kind of amenities that are, coexist and are co-located within a small geographic area. So it's kind of like the middle in between the confetti and the citadel model. And that was Nashville, which has a fantastic downtown core, where comprising of Lower Broad area, which has these kind of historic honky tonks like Tootsie's and Layla's, and these are fantastic little music venues. But then they also have a big football stadium right across the bridge. They have the Ryman Theater. They have the Museum for Country Music, and they have a bunch of different like public streets that they use. And so that's kind of like the core model. And so I saw each of these cases as illustrating different relationships between the festival and the city space itself.
And would you argue that this was almost a meso study rather than a micro or macro, somewhere in between, looking at the way in which place also has a larger impact on the way in which society and the people within society interact based on their surroundings and based on the agency they carry?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think that my first project was a very micro-level study. I was interviewing people who are who are tour guides in New York City and how they use the city spaces to kind of weave together their own stories and use public spaces and public culture to make meaning for themselves and for the city itself. And it was a very very micro level research project. And when I'd be happy to talk about that more or less. And when I was looking for a second research project, I was still interested in cities and culture and how different actors kind of engage with cities and culture. I was looking for kind of a little bit more of a step up organizationally. So I was interested in the different actors who and organizations that play a part in shaping urban culture and city branding and city imagery. And so for this Music City book, I was interested in the mayor's office. I was interested in I interviewed the Chamber of Commerce. I interviewed the Convention and Visitors Bureau. I was interested in music organizations. I was interested in city council. I was interested in these kind of meso-level organizations that still, and how they kind of coordinate around the idea of music. All of these festivals were, interestingly, I mean, I think, is that all these music festivals, which are now largely embraced by their communities and their cities, were, you know, begrudgingly accepted at best by these organizations and by the kind of official, you know, stakeholders of the city. They were all arose out of counterculture, all arose out of, you know, they were seen as being, you know, suboptimal uses of public goods. And over the course of the last 20 years, as cities have moved into a very steep competition amongst each other for having a distinctive place character. This is a competition for tourists. This is a competition for residents. This is a competition for companies to move to your cities, where companies are becoming mobile. People are becoming more mobile. Cities want to be distinct. They want to show themselves as having good quality of life and having a kind of strongly defined place character. And so festivals are one of the ways that cities are able to point to themselves and say, you know, part of their offerings and say, look at what we do that's different from other cities, why you should move to Nashville, why you should move your corporation to Austin. And so over time, cities have become much more of a calling card, or I'm sorry, festivals have become much more of a calling card for cities. And that's why I think when looking at this meso level, I don't think I would really appreciated that or understood that unless I, you know, which is a serious policy argument. If I had just interviewed the musicians and the tourists at the kind of ground street level, street corner level.
It was interesting how well the cities kept themselves together during a time that could have been extremely socially disorganized. There's a great level of friction or status frustration between some in-groups and out-groups, the locals and the new people coming in for these festivals alone. The one example that I can think of right offhand is in Austin, where some of these smaller businesses started up their own little side jobs while the larger festivals going on in the community.
Yeah, I mean, those were, you know, businesses that were interested in participating in the festival and having these kind of alternative South by Southwest events. I mean, they appreciate the festival, right? They want to be a part of it because they know that they're bringing in tourists and they're bringing in music, you know, music folks from LA and New York City. They want Vice Magazine to pay attention to them or Pace Magazine or Fader to come and stop by their boutique, fancy boutique, fashion, you know, store. But it's really the locals who begrudge the traffic, can't go to their usual restaurants for the time that South by Southwest is in session. It's they can't get a rental car. They can't book an event. They can't go to their favorite bar because there's so many tourists coming in. I mean, the real friction comes from, you know, not the, you know, kind of cultural amenities folks, but everyday, kind of dwellers of the city, which is totally reasonable. In Austin, since we're talking about Austin, I wrote a piece called Welcome to Austin, Don't Move Here, which is, and it was in the Guardian newspaper. And it was because there is this sentiment among locals that it's, thank you so much for coming, but don't move here, because what they see is that South by Southwest is too successful. And Austin has experienced such staggering growth over the last 20 years. Some people, I think largely incorrectly, lay that blame to South by Southwest because it makes the city seem like a practical cultural Valhalla where you can just stop at every store and get free barbecue and beer and music, and it's an all you can eat Vegas buffet of music and indie culture. And of course, the city isn't always like that. You can see more music than you can anywhere else, live music than in Austin, Texas. But So I see that there's much more friction, and certainly that was the case in Nashville in the last, in the 70s and 80s, where you had, the country music folks would come in and on the radio grumbled amongst themselves. The city, their locals wanted to consider themselves to have the Athens of the South, of the city being a place of learning, of refined culture, and there are fantastic places. It's the home of Vanderbilt University and Fisk, and it has these great institutions of higher education and fine art. And then you would have folks coming in for the country music festival for the weekend who were not necessarily going to galleries, high art galleries. And so there was kind of a little bit of a break between what they wanted to see of themselves and what the folks that were coming in. And so their locals would often tell me stories about how on the radio they would have fanny pack counts, and they had kind of very disparaging terms to describe country music fans said on the radio. And times sure have changed, where now country music is seen as being one of the kind of real highlights and real placemaking characteristics of Nashville, Tennessee, even though it has a wide palette of different music options available to locals and tourists alike. I think that those days have largely come and gone. I think for now for the most, and then I guess my third case is also another example of this, because the Newport Jazz and Folk Festivals in the 1960s were run out of town. I mean, here you have the Astors and the elites staying in the fancy New York mansion or Newport mansions. And then you have, the civil rights era. You have African American musicians. You have hippies coming to the folk festival. There's obviously disparity between the locals and the folks that were coming in for those festivals, so much so that they decided to close down and not permit the festivals to happen again. It was only later, 10 years later, where people started realizing that festivals actually did bring something to the city of Newport. And that they invited George Ween, the founder of the festivals, to come back to Newport and start up the festivals once again. And so in each of my cases, festivals were hardly seen as being the future of the city. They were only kind of begrudgingly accepted. And it was only recently in the era of post-industrial consumerist experience culture where festivals are now seen as being kind of one of the main strategies in urban cultural policy.
And I know you didn't get too much into this with placemaking, but do you see this as being a form of low culture if we are to go into that discussion, or is it becoming fancier? I see it as being popular culture to some degree, being there for anyone, and particularly in Newport, you were talking about how it's almost how this event is almost seen as being imposed on them.
Yeah, I think right. Well, the first thing you were saying about low or high culture. I mean, I certainly think it's a malleable format for any kind of culture. Certainly is popular culture in the sense that people really enjoy going to festivals lately. Somewhat paradoxically, I say in the book, in the sense that we live in an age where music is freely available. You can listen to any kind of music that you want almost immediately through any of a number of different kinds of streaming services, that people are not buying music as a tangible good anymore, and instead are buying music as an experiential one. And so there is this kind of festivals are the Newport Folk Festival sells out their tickets. I think they're already sold out for August of next year, or late July. They sell out every year before you even have any understanding of the lineup. Like, the lineup isn't announced. They haven't announced a single artist, and they've already sold out their tickets for next year, or almost sold out. I haven't checked.
Did you strategically select these three different genres of music, or did it just happen to be folk, indie, and country?
Um, it it was a combination of interests and also opportunity. And I think it was largely driven by the cities themselves as being kind of mid-tier cities in the as far as population go, being in the 30s. Newport is a part of the Providence, Rhode Island metropolitan statistical area, right? So they're all, I think, 33, 34, and 36 or something like that. In the U.S. rankings, which I thought was kind of nice, that they were all trying to be more distinctive areas than while using music as a part of it. And so I make the case in the book that there are more Charlestons that are trying to be like Nashville than there are Baltimore's trying to be like New York City, in the sense that there are a lot of cities that are trying to kind of compete with each other in the middle, right? You're not overtaking. There's much chance of overtaking New York City or LA or Chicago, although Houston's going to give it a good try over the next 50 years. You know, for the most part, there's a lot of more, struggle for defining place in the 20s and 30s and 40s, where you have a real chance of like living or dying over the next few decades. And so I was much more interested in that than the particular genres themselves. If I was interested in a little bit more diversity in genres, I think I would probably have gone to a different location, like Atlanta, if I was interested in hip hop or something like that, or maybe Miami, if I was interested in EDM and its relationship there. But it was, I think I actually see a lot of similarity between those genres. There's, there's alternative indie music at South by Southwest. The folk music scene is largely what's called Americana. And then there's country music. And I see Americana as being kind of it's not just me, but it's kind of conceptualized as being a bridge in between indie music and country music of these older traditions. So, and it reinvented for the new moment. So I think that they probably have more relationship to each other in regards to the genres themselves.
Sort of sew this all together. You talk about how you write about how these different locations have struggled financially because of the lack of call it government support or local support. However, you also write that there are some other countries that are more socialist and more supportive of the music. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think, yeah, I mean, the places aren't struggling. I don't want any listener to think that Nashville is struggling in any way or Austin is struggling in any way, right? I mean, I think that, not in any way, but in most ways, I guess, right? I mean, all cities struggle over issues of gentrification or crime or things like that, right? So, I think what I'm talking about relating festivals in the U.S. and urban culture and culture and music in the U.S. versus other countries, I started hearing from the people that I interviewed, and certainly I interviewed not just the Convention and Visitors Bureaus. I was interviewing mayors, I was interviewing volunteers and locals and the shop owners, but I also interviewed a lot of musicians, and a lot of the musicians, particularly folk musicians, talked a great deal in a comparative way. And so they would often compare the U.S. with Canada or with other countries and the support of music in other countries. I mean, it's you go to Canada and you talk to music folks and you ask them to name a musician who hasn't received some government funding, that you've heard, any musician that you've heard of or any band that you've heard of, and they're hard pressed, because almost every act that are known internationally has been supported by the government. And when comparing festivals, folk musicians will say that they, for an American festival, you go and you get paid and you perform and that's largely the end of it, and then you leave. And if you go to folk festivals in Canada, and there's quite a lively folk festival scene in Canada, you always sign up for one performance and then another performance with another act, and then you have to do like two community organizing, kind of with boys and girls clubs in local, local, kind of groups. and that there's always this built-in kind of component to it that requires them as part of the job is to come in and educate about music and about folk music. And it just rings so novel to my ear as an American, as somebody who's been studying, you know, urban culture for a long time, that I definitely wanted to have that to be a part of the story in this book, because I was interested in how, or I wanted to say we should be investing in festivals, but it shouldn't be, you know, purely market driven, that cities should be supporting this and asking for something in return. Cities give up permitting, cities give up streets, cities give up time on the event calendar of the city and for these festivals, and they should be getting more in return for it, and they should be asking, you know, musicians to give to the communities. And I think that they do in a lot of ways, but just not in the same ways that they do in Canada. So for example, in the Country Music Fest, CMA Fest, which is the Country Music Association Music Festival, or CMA Fest, all the musicians aren't paid. So, I mean, all the main musicians aren't paid. Their backing bands are paid, and the crew is paid. But the, you know, kind of the big name talent do participate in the festival for free. And all of the money and profits go back into music education into Nashville. And all, you know, they used to come to the Country Music Festival, and they would, each musician would kind of have their pet project that they cared about. So they would work with they'd have all their fans kind of come to the music festival and donate money to the local homeless shelter, for example, or a domestic violence shelter or something, or whatever project they had. And the Country Music Association decided that they wanted to kind of corral all of that collective goodwill and philanthropy and really invest it into the city itself. And so they so millions of dollars have been funneled into Nashville's music education program. Providing, you know, facilities, instruments, and human capital, and that's that's absolutely something that is how this, you know, these festivals bring in resources and funnel them into the local, you know, local communities, not just the local economy, but local communities.
What is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, it's a good question. So, so I did these two projects, and I definitely was thinking about what I should be, you know, kind of turning my attentions towards. And when you, after you get tenure, you start thinking about what you're going to be doing next. I was thinking, do I keep on doing kind of urban culture, or should I try and branch out a little bit? And certainly, when you start having kids and you get tenure and you start focusing on your teaching and all these and all the service requirements that come with being a university professor, you it's easy to kind of still do the same kinds of things. And I decided that I was going to do the harder thing. And because I have a good relationship with somebody who's a health policy scholar, over the years we thought about working together, we thought it would be really good to think about how health policy and cities kind of intersect with each other. And so right now I'm working with two people at Ohio University, Dan Skinner and Berkeley Franz, and the three of us are doing a three-city comparative study of hospitals as anchor institutions in local economies, as you know, kind of like as brick and mortar buildings that are on the one hand, very inward thinking in the sense of being, you know, taking care of people inside the building itself. And at the same time, they are vast. They are part of a vast healthcare network, both as far as policies go and as far as their organizations are concerned. Being the sense that the healthcare systems are buying up hospitals, right? But then also how hospitals are relating to their local communities as well. And so there's kind of often the impression that high-end hospitals are more often oriented towards healthcare tourists, people who are kind of wealthy and flying in from other cities to come to a bone and joint center, for example, and get highly specialized care, top-level care, and then not hospitals not serving their local communities that are right around their, you know, their brick and mortar, right on the outside of the walls. And so we want to look at, you know, kind of what those relationships are. And we've been focusing on Denver and Cleveland and Hartford, Connecticut, for a variety of reasons, you know. So I think I'm still working on the, like, three different city model of doing research. I'm trying to broaden my scope a little bit by including some adding in the area of healthcare to my skill set.
Are you looking at the urban areas of these three locations as compared to more rural hospitals? My wife and I and our two kids live in Pella, Iowa, which is a very rural community, and those hospitals have a much different presentation than what I would think the urban hospitals would have in their communities.
Yeah, I mean, we think we're interested in how how hospitals, you know, kind of stay in place after a long, you know, kind of decades long relationships. And so we're kind of interested in those older stories and as compared to other hospitals that maybe move to be more strategic in how they, you know, kind of bring in people. And so I think that urban hospitals are a definitely an interesting beast in the sense that they are kind of compelled to work with their communities in a meaningful way. And so I think there's really something there. You know, certainly somebody else, one of the listeners, can take on a project about rural hospitals after we finish up our book. They can critique us by talking about rural hospitals. I think that would be completely valid.
And strengthen the book by citing your book with your colleagues and putting it out there, further marketing the book.
Yeah, sure. We're not at that stage yet of the research, but sure, that sounds great.